Good evening, everyone. My computer finally decided I belonged on this call. It is 9 p.m. Eastern Time on February 15th, 2018. This is the Committee of Safety Call. And now if we have Captain John, we'll get started.
Hey, everybody. Good evening to y'all. Okie dokie. We're going to pick up on Amendment 22, so we'll get right into it. This was passed on March 21st of 1947, post-war years, and it was ratified February 27th of 1951. So that was like four years difference. So this one, interesting, took a long time to ratify, and I think that's probably the biggest space we've seen so far. Section 1 reads, no person shall be elected to the office of the president more than twice, and no person who has held the office of president or acted as president for more than 2 years of a term to which some other person was elected president shall be elected to the office of president more than once. But this article shall not apply to any person holding the office of president when this article was proposed by Congress, and shall not prevent any person who may be holding the office of president or acting as president during the term within which this article becomes operative from holding the office of president or acting as president during the remainder of such term. Huh, that's kind of interesting. I'm trying to place in my brain, Roosevelt was president, and then I forget who followed him. And somewhere in there, that four-year period had to do with that election, although I'm oblivious to why. But it brings up an interesting question in my head, anyway. And Section 2 reads, what, somebody was going to say something? Somebody got some insight on it?
Truman is in that period.
Truman followed Roosevelt?
Yes.
So I wonder why there was some hunky and a dory there between the Roosevelt and the Truman presidency. Interesting. Anyway, Section 2, the article shall be inoperative unless it shall have been ratified as an amendment to the Constitution by the legislatures of three-fourths of the several states within 7 years from the date of its submission to the states of Congress. So we see, as we get later into these amendments, they put that little clause in there that I just read. That's kind of interesting as well. So our little notes from the NLA will mention that this limits presidents to 2 terms of office. And until President Roosevelt, the principle set in motion by George Washington was to serve no more than 2 terms. But after President Roosevelt was elected to 4 consecutive terms, Congress was moved to pass this amendment. Ah, so there we go. It's right in front of my face. So there's the answer to the question. Roosevelt was elected to 4 consecutive terms. And, of course, we know what a hayseed he was, so we're not going to get into that at the moment. All right, so that was the 22nd Amendment, so it's pretty clear. The 23rd Amendment. And this was passed by Congress on June 16th of 1960 and ratified March 29th of 1961. So roughly a year. And Section 1 says, the district constituting the seat of government of the United States shall appoint in such manner as Congress may direct a number of electors of president and vice president equal to the whole number of senators and representatives in Congress to which the district would be entitled if it were a state, but in no event more than the least populous state. They shall be in addition to those appointed by the states, but they shall be considered for the purposes of the election of president and vice president to be electors appointed by a state, and they shall meet in the district and perform such duties as provided by the 12th Article of Amendment. So that's kind of interesting, where it gets into how they hornswoggled the Electoral College. I don't know if a lot of people understand this whole Electoral College thing, but as it states in this amendment, they come up with 535 people who pretend they're senators and House of Representatives members, congressmen, and then they vote in secret for who actually becomes president. A popular vote don't mean squat, in case you didn't know that. And our NLA notes says this extended the right to vote in the presidential election to citizens residing in the District of Columbia by granting that electors of the district join the Electoral College as if the district were a state. So once again, the U.S. Inc., the corporation, gets their digs into our craw just a little bit more. So there you go. Section 2 reads, the Congress shall have the power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. And we have that term again. What is appropriate legislation? We still don't have, I don't have a legal definition on that, though. I haven't bothered to look it up to see what may come up with that. Okay, so now we're up to Amendment 24. This was passed by Congress on August 27th of 1962, ratified January 23rd, 1964. So this is right around the time of the Kennedy assassination. If I remember correctly, it was around August when he was shot, was it not? I think it was in that neighborhood. I know it was summer. So here we go. The 24th Amendment reads, the right in Section 1, I should say.
Oh, yeah, they talk more about government stuff.
So the Section 1 reads, the right of citizens of the United States to vote in any primary or other election for president or vice president, for electors for president or vice president, or for senator or representative in Congress, should not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state by reason of failure to pay poll tax or other tax.
What?
There's an open line here on the phone, and it is actually distracting me. Please mute out.
Hello?
Thank you. I'm going to reread that because I lost it. Section 1, the right of citizens of the United States to vote in any primary or other election for president or vice president, for electors of president or vice president, or for senator and representative of Congress shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state by reason of failure to pay poll tax or other tax. So I guess what they mean what they say there, and it all had to do with taxes. You could not be prevented to vote because of taxes. Okay, so Section 2 reads, the Congress shall have the power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. Okay, so we're beginning to see these disclaimers regularly in the later amendments. I find that quite interesting. In our notes, it says it prohibits both Congress and the states from conditioning the right to vote in federal elections on payment of a poll tax or any other type of tax. Okay, so that's pretty much saying exactly the same thing. No additional information there or clarities. So we've got that. All right, so that's the 23rd. I've got a little trouble here with my tablet. Hang on here. Okay, so that was 24, so now we're on 25, and that was passed by Congress on the 6th of 1965, and ratified February 10th of 1967. So that was almost 2 years, year and a half. Section 1 reads, in case of the removal of the president from office or of his death or resignation, the vice president shall become president. Chain of succession. Section 2. Whenever there is a vacancy in the office of the vice president, the president shall nominate a vice president who shall take office upon confirmation by a majority vote of both houses of Congress. What you think about it is kind of interesting because most major presidential appointments, it only requires the approval of the Senate, all the cabinet members, all that kind of stuff, judges. But here, for vice president, it requires confirmation by both houses. So, That's a little different. Whenever the Section 3 reads, whenever the president transmits to the president pro tempore of the Senate, we used to call it president pro se, but whatever, pro tem, rather, of the Senate, and the Speaker of the House of Representatives, his written declaration that he is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, and until he transmits them to them a written declaration to the contrary, such powers and duties shall be discharged by the Vice President as acting President. So if the President says, I'm too sick to continue, but I'm not leaving office, the Vice President immediately moves in as acting President without anything further going on, provided the President did the paperwork as stated here in Section 3. Section 4, whenever the Vice President and a majority of either of principal officers of the executive departments or such other body of Congress as may by law provide transmits to the President pro tem of the Senate and a Speaker of the House of Representatives their written declaration that the President is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, the Vice President shall immediately assume the powers and duties of the office of acting President. Now, that's a pretty sticky wicket. Anybody that's ever been involved with involuntary confinement for mental health reasons with a family member knows that it doesn't take a whole lot of lies from two or three people, all of which are family members in the case I just mentioned, to have you committed. And there's not a whole lot you can do about it. And here we can see that they can do the same thing with the president. So I understand the good side of that. Well, if the guy's had syphilis and went off his rocker, we should pull him out of there. But under the circumstances of the world that we live in, I find that a very dangerous option. And interestingly enough, nobody's ever tried it. At least I've never heard of anybody in all the shenanigans against Trump at the moment even broach this subject. So for the time being, I guess nobody's thinking of it. And so it continues. Thereafter, when the President transmits to the President pro tem of the Senate and the Speaker of House of Representatives his written declaration that no inability exists, he shall resume the powers and duties of his office unless the Vice President and a majority of either the principal officers of the Executive Department or of such other body as Congress as may law provide transmit within 4 days to the President pro tem of the Senate and a Speaker of the House of Representatives, their written declaration that the President is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office. So point, counterpoint, parry, and thrust. They can come back, and now we've got three letters that have been written. Thereupon, Congress shall decide the issue, assembling within 48 hours for that purpose, if not in session. If the Congress was within 21 days after receipt of the latter written declaration, or if Congress is not in session, within 21 days after Congress is required to assemble, determines by two-thirds votes of both houses that the President is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, the Vice President shall continue to discharge the same as acting President. Otherwise, the President shall resume the powers and duties of his office. Now, I will tell you what was running through my mind as I'm thinking about this amendment. If you understand the dark side, the cabal, the deep state, whatever you want to call them, plans things out way ahead of time in terms of decades and half a century and a century, I'm beginning to smell rats with these last couple of amendments. And what happens if they actually get a president that they didn't control? Now, of course, they've had a president that they controlled since Kennedy, so there's nothing that they were overtly concerned about until Trump showed up. They had a long run of presidents they controlled until Trump showed up. But I suspect, and it's just my opinion, I've got no research to base it on, I suspect that these amendments were written in for that very purpose. But if they do lose control, this is one mechanism they have available to them to regain control of the presidency or to steal it outright. So that's my thought on that subject. So now we move on to Amendment 26, and that was passed by Congress on the 23rd of March, 1971, and ratified July 1 of 1971. So that's a quickie. Holy crappage. That may be one of the shortest days. March to July was at 4 months. Holy moly. This was a quickie. Section 1 reads, the right of citizens of the United States who are 18 years of age or older to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of age. And, of course, the Vietnam War was seeing signs of winding down at that point. It had been on for a while. It was still hot and heavy. And so it's kind of interesting because we have this clarification of the right of 18-year-olds to vote. During the same time the conscription was in operation. So that's kind of interesting to me historically. And Section 2 reads, Congress shall have the power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. So now I look over at our notes, and this modifies Amendment 14, Section 2 of the Constitution, prohibiting the states and the federal government from using age as a reason for denying the right to vote to citizens of the United States who are at least 18 years old. The drive to lower the voting age from 21 to 18 grew across the country during the 1960s, driven in large part by the broader student activism movement protesting the Vietnam War. Ding, ding. The impetus for drafting an amendment to lower the voting age arose following the Supreme Court decision in Oregon v. Mitchell, which held that Congress may establish a voting age for federal elections, but not for state or local elections. Now, that's kind of interesting. Okay, so that was all. Yeah, I was right. That was all about the Vietnam War. Okay. So, look, you got to understand when I say things like this, I'm talking historically. Of course, that was just another ploy by the Democrats to get votes to maintain control. So that's a political statement. I mean, that's a historical statement, not a political statement, the historical fact. All right, moving on to Amendment 27, which was originally proposed September 25th, 1789. And ratified May 7th, 1992. Now, isn't that interesting? Holy crap. It says, no law varying the compensation for the services of the senators and representatives shall take effect until an election of representatives shall have intervened. Okay, so this prohibits any law that increases or decreases the salary of members of Congress from taking effect until the start of the next term, set of terms of office. And isn't it interesting that it took from September 25th to 1789 until May 7th of 1992 to ratify? Well, that's a very interesting historic fact. It's a good trivia pursuit question right there. And so that basically completes our Constitution and amendments. And so I could move into something else, which is the county sheriff, but I'm going to hold off on that because I've got another subject that I would like to discuss here, which we have talked about before, but perhaps not in this context. And the subject is record keeping. And it doesn't really matter whether it's your own personal court case, whether you're starting up a committee of safety, whether you're going to a local public agency meeting like the school board or the law committee or the finance committee, whether you're buying a car, whether you're negotiating a contract, whether you're getting a credit card, I don't care what it is. You have to be able to keep good records. I'm dealing with a situation right now, and this is not unusual is often the case. The individual is working on their court case, and two things that I immediately ask if I'm actually going to try to help you is that I want the court case file, every page from square one to square last, from day one to day current. I want every document, and I want your affidavit, or at least a handwritten story that I can put into an affidavit form from square one, day one. This was the day I was issued the citation. This was who was there. This was the date. This was the time. This was the location. This is the names of the people that were there. That's on the very first day you got your ticket or your citation or you were arrested or you were served a summons. That starts the clock ticking. And the court file will give me an opportunity to see what mistakes they made. I have mentioned on several occasions I no longer have any use for the statutes and codes as it applies to us. That is a ridiculous assumption. Durash, the NLA, myself, and every other person will use the statutes against the people to which it applies. That we'll do. But if you're going to go to court and scream statutory violations against yourself, well, good frickin' luck with that. But my point is, in that case file, I will see process violations. I will see procedural violations. I will see style violations. And by style violations, I mean the wording. This is all really frickin' important. Simple stuff. You get a summons for a foreclosure from a foreclosure mill, and the lawyer that signs the document calls himself Johnny Smith. That's how he signed it, Johnny Smith. You go to your state records, and you pull up the bar attorney number, and the guy's name is John Michael Smith. That is fraud upon the court. That is color of law. That is a style violation. There's no such person as Johnny Smith. It's John Michael Smith. So when you give me your court file, I can look through these files and I can find all these procedural violations. Now, why do they have merit as opposed to all these statutory gurus who are perfectly right in spewing their nonsense, but get absolutely nowhere because the court ignores them? Well, the procedural violations are appealable. Now, what does that mean? That means that the judge in the original case has to whip out his checkbook and pay for the original case. And they don't like that very much. I think by now everybody on this call knows that every attorney is told to bring their checkbook to court for every appearance for that same reason. So this is why process and procedural violations are very important, and you will be able to find them in all the documents that they issued in your court case, and that's in your court file. Now, most people don't understand how important this is, and I had to deal in a very personal way with this subject years ago. In keeping every document and keeping it in chronological order. This person I was dealing with was having a very hard time understanding why I wanted it in chronological order. And when I started helping on the case, it took me a long time to put these frickin' documents in chronological order. And this individual reshuffled the deck and put it in a form that she thought made sense. I cannot tell you how livid I was. I went ballistic. The reason that you keep it in chronological order is so that you can write your affidavit. You should be taking notes. I mean, you don't think about it when a cop is writing you a ticket, that the moment he pulls away, the first thing we want to do is put it in gear and drive off. No, you should whip out your notebook and start taking notes of everything that just happened. That's what you should do. But we don't do that. Well, at least when you have your court file and you have the documents in chronological order, it will also jar your memory so that you can put your story together accurately. So keeping records is incredibly important. Like I said, you never know. If you're just applying for a credit card, if you're applying for a credit card at Sears or Kohl's, you know, or a gas station, you should keep accurate records because you never know when you're going to need all that stuff. Now, we can talk a little bit, too, about if you were keeping your records as they were issued to you, anytime that there's a proceeding, you should get a notice from the court, and you should keep that. And anytime there's a motion, you should get a copy and keep that. And every time the judge makes an order, you should keep that. And you should keep that in chronological order. And so it's a cumulative thing. And I always suggest that once a week, you go to the court clerk, the clerk of the court, and pull your file, having your copy of your case file in your hand, and go through it page by page. Now, I've gotten involved with some cases that ran 4 or 5 years. There's 300 pages in that file. So what? I will tell you. That documents get inserted that you never heard of. Documents get removed that you didn't know were taken. Documents get altered. They said one thing when you put it in there, and it says something completely different. And you never know when these mucky mucks are going to do that. So when I tell you, not only should you have a copy of your case file, but that you should check it weekly with your ongoing case, I mean it. And I'm dealing with a situation right now where the individual just started mumbling about public defender had some documents that he had never seen before that he saw for the first time last week. And I was livid because I had asked a month ago to get me a copy of the court file. I can't do anything for you unless I have the case file and your affidavit. Or at least your story that I can put in affidavit form. But it's got to be as accurate as can be and in chronological order. And so I can't emphasize enough how important it is, no matter what you do. If it's your committee of safety and you're going to a meeting, and like Robert said, you got a designated speaker, and there's four other people there, somebody better be taking notes of that entire affair and who was there and who attended for the public agency and what was discussed and did they follow Robert's rules of order? Did they discuss what was posted on the agenda? These kinds of things are incredibly important. You've got to keep good records. It's all in the paperwork. And so I've already, you know, you can go back and listen to my call about affidavits and what to do with them. You shouldn't do anything. You shouldn't scratch your butt in the morning and have a cup of coffee before you write an affidavit, as far as I'm concerned. So anytime you do make an appearance, you should immediately write an affidavit. John DeRash has been screaming this for years. He's absolutely right. You know, we talked, Robert and I have joked about walking into the courtroom as an observer with a big yellow legal pad. Well, it's funny and it's powerful and it's a psychological dig, but also take some frickin' notes because it's important. And I know many of us are very weak on keeping records, on keeping good notes. I am here tonight to remind you, because it has been reminded to me, how critical this can be. And so I wanted to bring that up also tonight, and with that I yield and I open up the floor.
Okay, how about the capital letter name? Is that yours or theirs? Is that important?
Why would you even bring that up in this conversation?
It's fiction. Isn't it fictitious?
Why are you bringing that up in this conversation about
Well, I think it's an error. Isn't that a fictitious name that's an error? Isn't
that
wrong?
That is a long discussion that we're not going to get into here because
you're
not
ready for it. Well, educate us. Tell us why. That's what we're here to learn.
I have mentioned before that it's all about standing. When you understand you are stateless, that you have no nationality of any kind, you can come back and then we'll get into that.
Well, I think there's a lot of people that don't know. I'm not the only one.
I'm not interested
Anyways,
in discussing the subject on
You're not
this
teaching
call.
Us then.
Nope, I'm not interested in statutory crap. It is irrelevant to what we do.
That's the point. That's the point. It's statutory, and we're not a statutory man, are we?
I have told you before, if you had listened to my calls prior, that what I suggest, since everybody is a human being and everybody
human is
has
color
unalienable
of law.
Rights, are you going to listen or are you going
well,
to
Well, human is color of law. Hue is color. Color man.
Whether
I'm just talking without the fiction.
That's statutory crap that is worthless to my commentary.
Right. I agree.
And I will
so
tell
you. So why are they sending us stuff
that, since
that has
you are
a fiction
a creature,
name?
Since you are a creature of source, a
No, a man. No, not a creature.
Then you have unalienable rights, which is the point. And when you have unalienable rights, then you can use the treaty violations, specifically the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, the rights and duties of man,
yeah, but human
and the rights of a child
is still fiction.
To use in proffering your position. And either you get that or you don't, because it's very simple. I just explained it to you.
Well, tell us some more
details.
Right
there. That's
so
the
everyone,
answer to your question.
Does everyone know what he's talking about? Human is color. Hue, man, color of man. That's statutory.
All right, we're
going to
move
fictitious.
On here because you're just fixated on what you want to do.
Dan,
well,
I'm
not
interested. You, Dan, you're,
Go
you're
ahead, Nikki.
In control.
Okay, may I have the floor?
Oh, absolutely. Go ahead.
Okay. What I suggest is that, you know, as far as human and this and state and that, you know, go back to the original intent of these constitutions, Declaration of Independence, and so on and so forth, and go back to the dictionaries at that time to define the words. And if you go to Johnson's, J-O-H-N-S-O-N-S, Johnson's, apostrophe S, Dictionary of the English Language, 1755 or 1830, depending on which one you want to use. If you use the 1755, that's great. Go to the 1755 version, and you will see that state, S-T-A-T-E, meant the republic. And that is the state or condition. I will go ahead and read it from the 1830, because the 1830 is quite a bit more clear. And state is a condition, circumstances of nature or fortune. So it has nothing to do with whether the name is capitalized or whether it's small letters or whatever. Modification of anything is the state. Stationary point, crisis, put my glasses on here, height, point of which next movement, regression, a mode of government, a community, the public, the commonwealth, individuality, civil power, not ecclesiastical, but civil power. This is what it says actually in the 1830 Johnson's Dictionary of the English Language. The state goes on to say, a republic, a government not monarchical. Rank, condition, quality. So we all have a state of being. Pomp, appearance, greatness, dignity, grandeur, depending on our behavior, right? A seat of dignity, a canopy, a covering, dignity, a person of high rank. The principal persons in government joined with another word is signifies the public. A state of being, a state of affairs. But then again, it goes down, okay, in that same dictionary definition on that same page of the 1830 Dictionary of the English Language. It goes down in state monger, state room, and then it has states, S-T-A-T-E-S, and that means nobility, okay? So what we're arguing about as far as words go and whether they're capitalized, not capitalized, and so on and so forth, what was the meaning back when these documents were penned? It is very important to use the dictionaries at that time so that we are not going off on tangents about, you know, things that really don't mean anything to us today, except that they have enslaved us by use of these particular words.
Where'd you go, Nikki?
Say again?
Very good, Nikki. The state is your status at that moment of anything.
Exactly.
Your status is a whatever, a human or whatever. So, and when it becomes plural states, you know, then it is, you know, the union, but as a complication, they took it to nobility. And I was looking up republic in modern dictionaries, and they describe it as a republic by qualified voters elect representatives. And I bet I would like to know what the definition of republic was back in that 1755 dictionary.
Go to it, 1755, Johnson's 1755 dictionary. It's online. And, you know, find out.
Well, I just want to jump in here. I do not wish to belabor the original question, but I'm going to get back to it in context of what Nikki just stated. For those that are in the extremely advanced classes, who really know what they're talking about, there are two, and if you don't, these are the things that you need to go look up, because it also, if everything that Nikki just said has to do with the context in which you find the use of that word, and that comes under an evil little term called glossa, G-L-O-S-S-A. Now you're getting really close to the evil art of how these guys put stuff together in sentences and paragraphs using the definitions as Nikki just explained it to you. And I will tell you, if you're actually that smart, then you need to pick up the 16th edition of the style, Chicago Style Manual. And when you understand glossa, you understand the 16th edition of the Chicago Style Manual, and you understand what Nikki just said about definitions, then you have some idea of what the hell is going on. To pull out these statutory definitions that the statutory gurus and given and all of this, that, the other thing, out of context of the definitions that Nikki gave you, without understanding glossa and the 16th edition of the Chicago Style Manual, which is the rules the bad guys play by, you are totally lost. And that is why I have little patience when questions like this come up, because it's way above and beyond the nature of anything that we do or you need to know. Now, I wish to get back to the subjects at hand, which were the last few amendments, and more importantly, keeping records, affidavits, and your court file. And those are the subjects that I want to focus on. How are you?
Captain John, what about the missing 13th Amendment?
Well, I talked about that last week. I'll just briefly say it again because it can't be said enough. Many years ago, I did about 3 or 4 months worth of research on the 13th Amendment. I mean, I went at it with a vengeance. And I read every lawful argument. I read every legal argument. I read every bar attorney argument. I read every Vatican argument, judgment. I read every damn argument, including the drunks in the street. And in this document that I had, it was a brilliantly put together piece. After having read all these separate documents and all these separate arguments over such a period of time, I'm talking 3-4 months, I came across the magic. And the magic was all in this one document, which I'm in possession of somewhere. And this guy took all those arguments, every damn one of them, and he went through it, and he pointed out in the end, which he made absolutely crystal clear and is irrefutable, is that it doesn't matter whether you're pro original 13th Amendment or con. What you can do is use it in your court case and throw the ball in their court, because there is no possible way that you can lawfully or legally prove that the 13th Amendment is still not in effect. Can't be done. Cannot be done. And that is my answer to your question.
And a point of information for anyone who has not seen the original 13th is that last week on the COS chat, I posted where you can find the original 13. So it's in the chat area there. There's a link to it.
And interestingly enough, I was just going through, I was looking for a particular document that I put somewhere, but I also had stashed in the file section of several of my Facebook groups. So I was actually going through the file section of some of my Facebook groups. People who have been members of Facebook for years don't even know there is a file section. Duh. Now, we have the National Liberty Alliance Illinois Facebook page. And I went through every document in our file section today. Just happened to do that. And you will find the original 13th Amendment in there as well. And I would not be surprised. I didn't have a chance to go through the Investigative Research Committee file section. But generally, if I put something in the Illinois Facebook page, NLA Illinois Facebook page, I generally, if it's a document that I've uploaded, I generally put it in the Investigative Research Committee files as well. So you can always, I suggest that you guys not only take a look at our website, which has awesome amount of information, and is very specific to what we do, and is very good with our specificity, but we also have our Facebook pages, file sections, that have a tremendous amount of good information as well. So I want to point that out, and with that, I yield.
Hello, how you doing?
Hello.
This is Crystal.
Hello, Crystal.
How's everybody?
Like I wouldn't know your voice.
Hi, Crystal.
I have some news. Hi, everybody. Okay, because I was trying to get on John's call the other night. What's been going on up here? As a matter of fact, they have those little sneaky devils had another meeting because, see, all the people are all riled up and all upset about these illegal foreclosures, this WPCA. And since I've been going to the court these past few years, and thank you, I thank each and every one of you for your help and stuff, people are now catching on. And it's so what's been happening. When I went to the court the last time, back in, was it last month? And so the judge said, because I put the subrogation in, and he goes, I might have to excuse myself from this case. And he goes, so what do you got to say for yourself? I said, yes, I want you off this case because you're partial and you're being prejudiced towards my situation. And I said, I have my proof and everything here. He goes, is that all you have to say for yourself? And I said a few other things. He goes, well, I'm not going to excuse myself from your case because you didn't mention my name. So this is what I'm going to do for you. I'm going to foreclose on your house on May 26th, and that's that. Little do they know remember I filed some other paperwork when I was doing all my affidavits, and thank you, keep all everything in order. I got everything in my name, even the grantee. I got the package together. I did send John the copy.
Crystal, if I may, because you can do everybody a great service and stay on topic here, would you tell our callers, when you went to go check your records one day, what you found? And this is just
Oh, yes.
Why don't you tell, because that's timely and it's on the subject. Listen to this, folks. This is why you checked the file.
Okay. So this is what I was doing, you know, when I was filing my records and recording everything, you know, I would go back to make sure they followed through. Okay, so I got the volume page and all that. So I said, I was going through the records, and I said, second party, because I have the affidavit, so everything is in my name. And then the 28th of December, I got the grantee deed is all solely in my name. But prior to that, thank God I did go back to check. I only said it has my name, and I gave myself life use, and it says second party, and the attorney's name was the second party. I said, excuse me, why is his name on my deed as the second party? I said, I would like to see the copy, and when I said, who put his name on here? They said, you did. I said, why would I put my enemy's name on my property when he's not my husband, father, and no relation to me? So I said, can you pull up the records and let me see what's filed? They put him as power of attorney over me.
Repeat that.
And
tell him again. Say it again.
This attorney, this and the town, I guess, of the town also, they put power of attorney over me.
Without your knowledge,
I said, so I filed a complaint. Matter of fact, it's under investigation right now. And what I did, I got the copies of everything. So I'm going to make sure the National Liberty Alliance gets a copy. I gave it to some other people because he is not. But the last one I did file, I guess that will bump it out the way. But I want it removed from there.
Now, what
and
you
I'm
want
to
do,
to...
Crystal, is you want to sue them and make a lot of money. And if it
well,
is in writing,
this is game
is
set match.
That they've
this
committed
is fraud.
Fraud
vitiates everything. She can sue. She can make money, but this throws everything out. This is it. That's game set and match. That's fraud. And she caught him. And she caught him because she checked her frickin' records.
Right, and I got the records. And also, now we got all these attorneys that are going around and evicting the people's property. So now the same paper, so this week we got four people, the property is back in their name, and they can't be put out or nothing. But see, what these idiot attorneys are doing here now, they are not checking the records. You know, when you do the title search, I used to work. So when I've been going to the different town halls and I'm helping the people file their paperwork, and they said, well, what is this? I said, we want this recorded on our deed. It's our affidavit. I will get you the copies and stuff. And I said, oh, my God, it will stop these foreclosures right in their tracks. And they said, well, where did you get this? I said, that should be your concern. I said, I would like this to be filed and recorded on our records. I said, everything's a sworn, notarized affidavit. She goes, well, if it's not legal, I said, oh, but this is legal, you know? And so they were running around like chickens and all the different, one, two, three, four different town halls. And they didn't know what they were doing. But especially when I went to where I used to work and in the other town, they were like, okay. They had to go speak to the city attorneys. So they go, yeah, you have to take it. It has to be filed. No problem. And I said, do me a favor. Can we have three certified copies of this? because one town, they told the lady, well, no, we're not going to take this. So she called me all the time. I said, you get right back in there, and you tell them you want this recorded on your deed. Get their name and their title. And I said, and make sure, I told you, bring three copies, and make sure they stamp each one. And if they tell you to leave, well, guess what? They stamped it. So if they didn't file it, they're in big trouble. So she goes, I would like these stamped, and they stamped it for her. And so then she goes, okay, well, come back this afternoon. So all her papers. Then the cops went to this person's house last Friday with the no good bank manager or whatever, I guess the person who was going to buy the house, and said, well, we heard that you were evicted and now that you're a squatter in this property. So she went back and showed them the papers that she filed, and the cops and the guys looked at each other, and they walked off her property. So she's all free and clear, too. I will send you, get that paperwork for you this week. I've been busy helping other people, but, and we're trying to get, I have to meet with the colleges and the schools and getting these kids registered and getting them going with this Natural Liberty Alliance, you know, so they can learn the writing and getting on these conference calls. Because it's beginning to be...
You're committed to quickly building...
I'm sorry?
Sounded like a raid.
Huh?
I don't know. That sounded like a raid. What the hell was that?
Yeah.
Keep going.
But you know, I got a letter when I got home this evening. I got a letter from the crazy attorneys, and it's from the court, and the judge signed off, and the attorneys. And they said, your house will be sold for on May 26th for $205,000, which is like my house is four times as much as that amount. And I said, okay. So, but meanwhile, I send the other paperwork to the attorney general. They're doing an investigation. As a matter of fact, this was the best one. When I called last week, and I got... make sure you get the date, name, and everybody who you speak to. And I said, so they gave me an investigator. So she started going through my case and stuff, right? And I said, somebody's perpetrated a fraud. They gave themselves 5 feet of my property. I've been harassed. And I said, the property is my property. And I sent them the subrogation and all that. So, and I said, and by the way, can I please have your name? So she gave me her name and all. She was very nice. She goes, well, let me see what I can do for you. It's like, as soon as you start asking the people, can I have your name and your title, you get a whole different response altogether, you know? Because now nobody's passing the buck. Because now, okay. And I said, you know, start from the governor, whatever I got to deal with. So anyway, she pulled up the records. She goes, well, I got good news for you. She goes, the property is solely in your name, and you're the grantee of the property. I said, I know this. And I said, I...
Duh.
Right? So reattorney, because you, and see, even on the paperwork with the, you know, because when you have to do, when you buy property, you have to fill out the IRS paper and all that. Now, this is really strange in our state, because there's four different papers. I said, we got the smallest state. Now, when I filled mine out, it was one sheet, but it only has grantor on it, okay? Attorney grantor, agent grantor, or grantor, and not no grantee. So I signed my name, and I put grantee, and I put the brackets around it, and all rights reserved, and that date, you know? And she goes, well, why did you write that? And I said, excuse me? And I said, could you please just file and say as little as possible, you know? And so she goes, well, why are you filing? Where did you get all these paperwork? I said, excuse me? I said, is there a problem? I said, everything is notarized. Can you please just record my records, you know? And I would like three copies of each. So they even, you know, it's just like, it's, I'm glad. So today when they sent me the letter, I said, this is beautiful. Because these idiots are sending me the letters, and then they told me that I got to pay almost $3,000 for attorney's fees. They're throwing all this other stuff on me, and no one's checking the records. Can you imagine that? So that's what I, you know, all this, you know, the subrogation, all the things, you know, I've been learning through you. I can't thank you enough. And, you know, and like everybody, it was funny because they had a big meeting at the city hall 2 weeks ago. And there was about maybe 500-600 people there, and everybody was going off on the city attorneys and all of them. So what happened, this time they subpoenaed all the city attorneys, and they looked like they wanted the crap in their pants. As a matter of fact, the same one I was in court fighting about, the illegal WPCA, I brought that out in the courtroom at the federal courthouse in the Superior Courthouse. And he ran out the courtroom. So when he saw me at City Hall last week, it was just like, you know, he was very antsy. But he's been the one who's been robbing and stealing. But it's like a team of them that are stealing everybody's property. And I said, you know what, another thing I had made mention of, I said, what everybody definitely needs to do, I said, anybody who sits there and wants to pass a bill or whatever, I said, all the lying politicians, everybody needs a sworn to be, have a sworn notarized affidavit on any decision and be held accountable for it. Why should we have to keep on picking up the tabs on their illegal activity? You know, then they won't be so hasty to sit there and say, well, we're going to do this, because, you know what I'm saying? Let them be accountable for it.
Yeah. I do everything by affidavit, and I expect an affidavit in return. It's not too bad.
Exactly.
For you.
And everybody says, that's a great idea. I said, yeah. You know, I said, and when we go to court, we don't even have a trial. And I said, by the way, anything over $20, we can have a grand jury. You know? And I said, when you go into the courtroom, it's just the attorneys and the judges. Like, you have no say-so. And I kept on asking, I would like a grand jury. We don't do this here. And so when they called me up, I said, I put my right hand up. I swear the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth to help me, Jehovah God. And I put the Bible on the table. You know what the judge told me? I don't want to hear that crap. You know, but as I said, it's really crazy and wild, and more people are starting to go to court. So I said, you know, and I said, when you got to go to court, let me know so we could go to court and we could be, you know, take the notes and give each other affidavits. I'm telling the kids, even in the schools, all of them, keep a journal, date, time, you know, on or about any witnesses there, and keep a journal of your on every day.
Absolutely.
That is your case.
Huh? There's quite a few lessons for everybody with committees of safety to learn with the stuff that Krista does. She keeps her records, she checks her records, she does affidavits, and she goes to meetings. You think it has an effect? I do. I know it does.
Oh, it does. Oh, definitely. As a matter of fact, tonight they had a meeting, but they didn't want me to know anything about it. I got a call.
I get that a lot.
Oh, really? Yeah. So somebody called me, but I couldn't make it. I said, that's okay, because I'm getting all my other paperwork filed through. You know what I'm saying? And so when people are called, I said, this is what you got to do. Here's the National Liberty Alliance calling your website. You know, get your family, your kids. I said, because I said, no, I'm not going to be overwhelmed. And I said, like I've been telling you all along. But they've seen the results, what's happening for me, you know. And now it's like, oh, yeah. And I said, even You know, after you have your Bible study, have a family study with this Natural Liberty Alliance, and it's about your Constitution, all your rights and stuff.
That's exactly how we got our Committee of Safety going up in Pulaski, Wisconsin. Our NLA members were so determined, they drove down to Chicago to meet with me, and then they went back, and we started working together. Bob was in jail. Everybody in jail called him all caps Bob, and they had great success. They filed their federal lawsuit. They got the county to back off. They got the cops to back off. The federal judge was on the county's butt, and voila, people started paying attention. They attracted attention, and they got a Committee of Safety going.
And that's great. The thing I'm going to need some help with is following. Oh, this is the question I had to ask, because Don did do a federal lawsuit. So this judge said to me, I see that you have a lawsuit against me. And I said, yes, there was papers filed. And he goes, who's your attorney? And I pointed to myself. He goes, I said, who's your attorney? I said, Jehovah God, Jesus Christ, and myself. You know? So another thing, so then all of a sudden the attorney ran out the court because she didn't know whether she was coming or going. And I saw her thing and a way to the other attorney sitting on the side bench for them to come and help her. So then she comes back and she goes, oh, Your Honor, the case was dismissed, the federal case. He goes, well, how do you know that? Because there's handwriting in it. She goes, oh, that's my handwriting on there. You know, now, was I supposed to submit that lawsuit case here in the Fairfield County that he filed in New York? Because I was like, that's what I was trying to find out from, you know, John.
Well, I can answer that question.
Can I interrupt?
Yeah, but let me answer the question first. And the federal rules are you can file a case in any district court, any federal district court whatsoever. It doesn't matter, anywhere in the U.S. And if it's in the wrong jurisdiction from their perspective, then they will forward it to the appropriate deal. So you don't even have to worry about that. They do that for you. And that's absolutely rock solid. And that's what I wanted to say. I rest.
Now, do I got to pay for that? So now the case I have...
Well, you know that's the game. That's the
okay. What I wanted to add was what would have been perfect to say right there when the judge is saying was it dismissed, to say actually it was not, because that judge that dismissed it committed fraud on the court, disqualified himself, his ruling is null and void, and the case still exists.
Very good.
Say that again. Okay, so it would be null and void. All righty. Well, and one other question I have to ask, but I got you on the phone. So the one that John, the paper that was filed back in, I guess, September, should I do another affidavit and amend this new affidavit with the previous one?
If you want to.
I amend complaints,
and I put in affidavits at will. Affidavits would be a continual process. I am constantly pounding court files with affidavits.
Okay.
But you can amend your complaint anytime you want. Your claim, not a complaint, a claim.
A claim.
Yeah. You can amend it as many times as there are cows in the field, man. No big deal. You can do it every day if you like.
Okay. All righty. All right.
Absolutely.
So I
you know, in
right,
saleboat racing, we call that tweaking. Tweak your claim.
Now, I tell you, but I just could not believe it. I said, oh, here they go again, you know. But it's just like nobody's on the same page. And another thing what they've been doing, too, is that they are evicting the people. Oh, this is the best one. There's about 9 cases that's going on right here that I know of personally. They've been sending these marshals to the house, and nothing is being filed in the court. And they told the people, we want you out by Saturday. So a few people had left their house, and they had a city truck to come and take their belongings. So when they went down to the court to go find out where their belongings was, guess what happened? This is the best one yet. They said, we didn't have you evicted. So the attorneys are committing the biggest fraud, and they're evicting people, and their stuff is being taken away, and they wasn't even evicted. And they're doing these things even on a Saturday. And it's like a false stamp.
It all boils down to they've been doing this and getting away with it because we've been letting them do it, consenting. And you're showing how to stop them. You're doing great work, Crystal. Keep at it.
Okay, but I just wanted to share that with you. Because like when I fall asleep and I saw, like, you know what? As I said, I said, let me stay awake so I can talk this thing. You know, but whatever, and I'm going to get those paperwork. So, you know, I mean, this is, thank you. I thank you all, and I love you all for, you know, that love and that support and stuff like that. And we're all going to do this together, you know. But I said, I think that's all. I think I said everything I had to say on that.
Back to the amendments.
You're talking to me?
Well, no, I was back to John's amendments. He's pointed something out, the amendment that restricts presidency to two terms. There's been a lot of discussion to trash all amendments after the 10th, and there's something that might want to be left. It's open to discussion. If we had a great president, I might want to keep him around longer than two terms, but just pointing that out. I want to talk about the 11th Amendment at some point, tie it into what Nikki is revealing about our early republic. 11th Amendment, how do people, do you all believe that a state has sovereign immunity when it injures one of its citizens? Should it have sovereign immunity? Does it? And that goes back to the time from Articles of Confederation right up to Declaration of Independence and when the Constitution was ratified. Where falls sovereignty of a state? And the Articles of Confederation existed before the states did, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, if anybody wants to comment on that. Because states are injuring us right and left and claiming 11th Amendment immunity.
Now, when you're talking about the states, you're talking about the states that is defined as nobility, correct?
One defined as, well, that's the way they exist now, as corporations. So what they're getting away with is by corporate rule or nobility rule.
Well, and, you know, the fact is that they're not even getting paid with their own constitutional coin. So,
which is fraud, too, and on and on and on. If you take a case, someone's been injured, and you let's say you've been thrown in prison wrongfully, mm-hmm. unconstitutionally, you want to sue the state of Pennsylvania for monetary damages, they're going to hit you with the 11th Amendment. Case going to be dismissed by some judge that you can't sue them for monetary damages. State or federal, we'll say that, a federal judge.
Have you read Blackstone's commentaries starting, well?
No, I haven't.
Because I just came across it. I mean, Blackstone was like 250 years ago, okay? And in Blackstone's commentaries on the English or the laws of England, okay, 1765, 1769, I'm looking at it right now on LONANG.com, If you go ahead and call that up, you probably could follow along, but if you know, you want. But, probably around halfway down the page, he's talking to a group of professors, apparently, okay? And he says in these two paragraphs, he says, making, therefore, due allowance for one or two shining exceptions, and this is going back 250 years ago, experience may teach us to foretell that a lawyer thus educated to the bar in subservience to attorneys and solicitors will find he has begun at the wrong end. If practice be the whole he is taught, practice must also be the whole he will ever know. If he be instructed in the elements and first principles upon which the rule of practice is founded, the least variation from established precedents will totally distract and bewilder him, so that law is written, it is the utmost his knowledge will arrive at. He must never aspire to form and seldom expect to comprehend any arguments drawn beforehand, they're using some Latin words in here, from the spirit of the laws and the natural foundations of justice. So already they were beginning to notice something is wrong here. Nor is this all, he goes on to say in the next paragraph. For as few persons, and in parentheses he has, as few persons of birth or fortune or even scholastic education will submit to the drudgery of servitude and the manual labor of copying the trash of an office, end quotes, parentheses, should this infatuation prevail. In other words, the infatuation with process, basically, is the way I'm reading it, prevail to any considerable degree, we must really expect to see a gentleman of distinction or learning at the bar. What are we seeing now? Very seldom a gentleman of distinction or learning is at that bar. And what the consequences may be, he goes on to say, to have their interpretation and enforcement of laws, in parentheses again, which include the entire disposal of our properties, liberties, and lives, end parentheses, fall wholly into the hands of obscure or illiterate men is a matter of very, very public concern. 250 years ago, it was prophesied what's going to happen today with the way lawyers were being taught. I'm ticked when I read this.
My response is I feel taken advantage of, and it's going to cost somebody a lot of money.
Yes. So bring this to their attention. You have achieved your goal. When it's all about process, form and process, and nothing about the substantive, you know, elements of lying, stealing, cheating, you know, hypocrisy, you name it, based on the basic 10. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. You know, I actually pulled up Blackstone's. Asked for Blackstone's one, and I didn't see anything under that other description as you were talking. Blackstone's one says we're going to put cookies on your computer and investigate you. So I didn't click on that.
You can see why he was so popular here in the colonies. And like Brent Winter says, there were 3 million here, 3 million folk here, and 8 million in England, and we had far more copies of Blackstone's commentaries than they did, and he was popular over there. You can see why. It's brilliant.
Obviously
stuff.
A moral man.
Yeah, but you know what he said? He believed that the common law did not apply to us. That was one of the things. That was one of the interesting tidbits about that. He thought it did not apply to us, but of course,
maybe
our founding fathers
felt threatened different at that point too. So. Often wondered why Washington and people like that weren't assassinated back then, but there was honor, you know, amongst adversaries, from what I understand at that time. You actually would,
yeah, well,
would duel it out or whatever. So, you know, back to King Arthur and
yeah.
Knights of the Round Table.
Well, they entered into that confederation, and it was when they put together that first paragraph of the Declaration of Independence, I mean, they noticed the problems of the past and what the remedies were for, you know, and they put it together very succinctly. So they recognized that it was almost like it was set up as a okay, you know, here we go. We're going to try to get along, you know, as best we can. And here's the deal. We dissolve the political bands. And, you know, you guys who want to assume amongst the powers of the earth separate and equal station, we'll give you a chance to do that. You know, you're the republic. And then they kind of, you know, put in the word states a few years later in order to achieve their goal. Well, it's in the dictionary now. You've got to go by this.
Mm-hmm. I'm now looking back at the Articles of Confederation, you know, as a stronghold, and I'm trying to identify the year that the Declaration of Independence, you know, began to be discarded. As what do you think, Nikki?
It's
subverted. 1781.
Oh, the Declaration of Independence.
Well, you know, when the subversion really started towards, you know, the writing of the Bill of Rights, obviously things happened there.
Right. Those were, you know, they saw what was happening. Apparently, there was that group who wanted to assume amongst the powers of the earth that separate and equal station without the political bands. And especially that Article 4, Section 3, where it says new states, you know, the way it's written in such language is that if they get the political bands back in there with the consent of the legislators and the Congress, they could erect new states. And in 1782, here in Pennsylvania, there was actually an act passed. This is a mere 6 years after the Declaration was signed, and it was years, you know, a couple of years before the U.S. Constitution was established. And at that juncture of time, in 1782, they actually, here in Pennsylvania, an act was passed to prevent the erection of any new and independent state within the Commonwealth.
And you said so, before 1785, they created what, the Bank of North America?
Yeah, that was in 17. It's actually on the blog.
I'm quoting. I think it was 1785. And you know, so yes, okay, we can see it, subversion right and left, and that's what I say.
Right.
King George said, this war has cost me too much money. We're going to let them have it. We'll figure out another way to get it back.
Right, and that's what they did with the Bank of North America is what it was called. And it's in the Pennsylvania statutes at large. You can just look up, a Bank of North America, and it'll probably come up. The acts that were passed to let it happen and then to stop it from happening, and then 6 months before the U.S. Constitution was established by nine states in 1787, you'll see that the Bank of North America was allowed to establish itself in Philadelphia. So that happened 6 months before that Constitution was passed for those bankers, apparently.
So they wasted no time.
They wasted no time. It was in the mix from the beginning.
They were amongst the founders as it all went down and just created a separate plan, conspiracy. We, the posterity, are living it out in terms that we couldn't imagine until we realized all this. So we were all injured. And take a look at what the heck's going on.
It's been fraud since the get-go, and there's no statutes of limitation on fraud, from my understanding.
Yes.
And it's all been by unconscionable and adhesive contracts.
What about all of the money during World War One and World War Two with the Lend-Lease that all of these conquered nations owe us for liberating them?
Good question.
That's that President FDR that served four terms, you know, that I was raised as a boy to believe was a great guy. Boy, he saved us from Hitler.
And he came in under the 20th Amendment on a day different than any previous administration, his last administration, right?
When I watch videos of him now, he does have real beady eyes.
And for a sick man, he sure did spend a lot of time in the office signing executive orders, over 3,000 in his presidency.
I think I recall it was over 3,000, but I
don't
quote me. You know, and that's the sickness of it. And as Monday nights, as I've heard lots of times from Mr. Garash, I haven't found an Article III court in the country. I don't think one exists.
Not anymore. I mean, I think that the 11th Amendment gutted it, didn't it?
Pretty much. Well, that and more. And when Crystal announces what's going on in Connecticut, I believe it is, that's mm-hmm. actually tremendous news and uplifting, because we're hearing about judges go, well, wait a minute, is there a case about this? You know, and then he says, oh, it's been dismissed, what she described. So they're aware of it. That's evidence. They're taking notice of it. And the movement is on, I would say.
I think so. I do believe it is. The truth will set us free, and just share the truth. That's what it's about. John sent me a message that he's having cell phone issues.
Okay, I wondered why he wasn't piping in.
Yeah, he says on hold now, may not get back in. So we can call it a night if everyone is ready. Robert, are you still on?
Like to make a comment first to Crystal. That would you please come back to the courtroom observers? That's where you should bring all of this up. Bye.
Crystal, are you still on? Robert? Who's manning the board?
CIA's got it right now.
Oh, very good. They're getting educated.
They're getting worried,
too. The spooks have it.
Say again?
The spooks have it.
The spooks have it?
The spooks, the CIA.
The spies.
Robert can't get back in, and John can't get back in, and it's, 10:30.
I would one night like to dissect the 11th Amendment, you know, for maybe a good 30 minutes.
You want to do that now?
Why don't we do it next week?
Next week, or just at some point, I'd like to set that up to do that. So, because to me, that is the crucial protection the bad guys have. And it's ridiculous when you read the 7th Amendment, the 11th, and how they've applied it. It's ridiculous. It's as ridiculous as everything else they're getting away with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and
okay.
Make sure. Yeah, and I would strongly encourage your reading of Blackstone's commentaries on the laws of England, especially section 1.
I've seen lots of citations I've read. I've just never gone into one of the books myself.
Yeah. Well, that first one, I mean...
It obviously is the original Bibles, and they say to just read the first or second black stones, so don't read the more modern ones. That's when they were rewriting them. That's when they were paying people off, so... And
regarding black stones... I know. They have it on audio tape, like books.
Yes.
So you can turn it on and sleep learn.
That's a good idea, Fred.
Yeah, I think it's on the NLA side, I believe, in audio.
Okay.
If I'm not mistaken. Okay, so the 11th Amendment, a half hour. I'll let John know, and
they premise their sovereignty, and it ties into the states are claiming sovereign immunity over us who created the states to protect us. That's a ridiculous assumption there, but they're doing it. But also the 11th, the wording does not fit what they use in their rulings. It's the opposite. It's like they're saying that if you have a black shirt on, you are protected, and then use the opposite wording to protect themselves, something like that. I'll bring it up. It's just ridiculous because I was injured by my state, and my reaction is to sue them for monetary damages and stop it. And it hasn't occurred, hasn't gone to court yet, but, you know, obviously they would say, dismissed, states have sovereign immunity. And all you can do is get a federal court to issue an injunction to tell them to stop running over you with the tractor-trailer rig, but no monetary compensation. In other words, they're protecting their bank account from us, and it is that if they didn't have that protection, they wouldn't do it because they wouldn't have any money in short order.
And what state are you in?
New Mexico.
Well, you're in New Mexico. Okay.
It's right there above Old Mexico.
I know where that is. Was your state's the Constitution submitted to the people for ratification? Have you ever checked?
Actually, it's been changed, according to a fellow here who has researched it, and he says he has a copy of the old Constitution, which I have not seen yet, and he says it's completely different from the new. This became a state in 1912, and what happened in 1913, 1916?
Mm-hmm.
And
yep.
New Mexico is basically a strategic national defense state that has always been controlled by the feds for military purposes, White Sands, it's the atomic bomb, Los Alamos,
mm-hmm.
Sandy National Labs. There's a whole history there of control.
Sure.
And so.
Yeah, check to find out if it was ever submitted to the people for ratification.
All right.
If it was not submitted to the people for ratification, maybe you can get it on the ballot and ratify it. And then everything will apply to you. Not you necessarily, you know, but the people.
All right, I'll look into that at some future moment. Great idea.
Yeah, it'll definitely raise eyebrows and have people, you know, kind of considering what it is that they're doing to the people. If it was never submitted and yet you've been enfranchised into that corporate, you know, state
mm-hmm.
without full disclosure that you were never, you know, you were never a party to that to begin with.
Participated in it, correct.
Yes. And with that, I yield. Jan, are you going to knock us off? Anybody else?
I think I might as well. I'll turn off the recording.